Session number 8266, Major William Pritchard Gordon, Part 1.
Where were you born, Major Pritchard Gordon?
In Shropshire. The village was called Upton Magna. And if you want the date, it was the 21st of August 1922.
What did your father do for a living?
He was wounded in the First War and was an ex-Grenadier Guards officer, junior at that. And he had a small property in Shropshire, which he endeavoured to farm, really, no more than that. He had a small income of his own.
Where did you go to school?
My preparatory school was at the back of Malvern in Colwall, under the very fine leadership of a wonderful man called W.P. Singleton. And from Colwall, the school was called the Elms. I then went to Shrewsbury School from 1936 to 1939.
And when you left, that was to do what?
I left early. I was not 17, and I, on the advice of a friend of the family, I left at the end of the summer in 1939 and went to work for the building contractors Sir Alfred McAlpine and Sons, you know, particularly lowly task, as the chainman to Mr. Engineer, i.e. the man that carries the staff and knocks the nails in the tops of the pegs.
So how did you come to be in Her Majesty's Forces? Or His Majesty's Forces?
I must have been nearly 2 years in McAlpine's, and had graduated to the position where I at least understood how to use the theodolite and level, and I'd been transferred from one site to another, that is to say, either the building of a aerodrome, ordnance factory, and I finished in 1941 working on night shifts in a mine in Corsham in Wiltshire, which was being converted from a stone mine into the Gloucester Underground Aircraft Factory. At this stage, I decided it was time I volunteered for military duty, and I was unaware of the fact that I was reserved occupation. This had been done as a kindness by McAlpine's, since I was the only son of my mother and she was parted from my father. I overcame this by volunteering in Bristol, and when informed that I was reserved occupation, I drove to Bath, got out my card, corrected what was written on the card, which said site engineer, stuck in the word student, returned to Bristol, and I was in the Royal Marines 4 nights later.
Why the Marines? You chose the Marines, did you?
A particularly easy answer. The chief petty officer on the drill hall in Bristol said I was too tall for the Navy, but exactly what was wanted by the Royal Marines. Looking him up and down, I didn't think I got many options, and allowed my name to go down on the Royal Marine Cadre.
And what type of work did you undertake in the Marines to start off with?
Well, I was put into the next training squad on Stonehouse Barracks, Plymouth. And that was the 129 squad, Sergeant Nicholas Carter. And I was the lowest form of life. I was Plymouth X-105-276 on 9 months training with the Royal Marines, intended to go to sea for duties in the gun turrets or whatever. And it was only after 9 months that I managed to get put forward for the officer selection course, which was a great relief to me, since nobody had been commissioned from the square of Stonehouse Barracks in the history of the barracks. It was a peacetime barracks, and it only produced Lurdeck and junior cadet officers. So the training basically was the parade ground, rifle, camp, fitness, a little navigation, normal preparation of a raw recruit for military service.
What was your attitude to the war when Chamberlain made the declaration that we were at war with Germany? What was your own personal attitude?
I heard that declaration on the radio and was probably more aware than most young people of what it might involve, in so much that the people I was working for were McAlpines, were already perfecting a double-actor trench-digging tractor, which I saw demonstrated at the Chiefs of Staff at Mark Wheel Hall in Wrexham. But, of course, war really only meant Maginot and iron and trenches, as far as almost everybody was concerned at that stage.
But were you in favour of the declaration that we were at war with Germany or not?
My belief is that we all accepted it as being totally correct and inevitable and just faced facts and went on with our lives, waiting until our turn came to be called up or volunteer.
Did there seem to be any enthusiasm for the war, or did people just accept it?
Amongst the young men, of course, there was bound to be a great deal of excitement. The wiser heads, for me, were particularly horrified and worried.
Why was that?
The better understanding of what happened in the previous contest, and with advanced equipment which we all knew to exist, it could be assumed that, and aerial warfare, it could be assumed that the loss of life would be catastrophic.
How did you get your commission in the Marines?
That's a story which I am still researching. It happened that there were 22 of us in the barrack room, in H Company barracks, and with all recruits, so they always put one old soldier in charge of each recruit's barrack room. And in our case, old Pop Gollop had to have some leave, and unfortunately somebody decided that I was the person to leave in charge of the barrack room. It happened that during the course of these 2 weeks, became the turn of the 129 squad to do the 40-mile endurance test, which meant leaving the barrack room at 4 o'clock in the morning and not getting back till 9 o'clock. And instead of the orderly departure from the barrack room every morning with all your kit laid out neatly on the trestle beds, the likes of the tips of your boots burnished, your sleeping attire, which was a form of shirt, hair shirt, rolled up like a jam roll and sewn at both ends, etc., etc., I left the barrack room in total disorder. When I got back from that march, Company Sergeant Major Dallin was waiting at the foot of the stairs, and he said, "You're wanted in the defaulters parade tomorrow morning." And I said, "Sergeant Major, why?" He said, "The state of your barrack room." To which I replied I was not surprised. I attended the defaulters parade, and the company officer when I came in, to my astonishment, congratulated me on the state of the bag room. So I didn't say anything, I just thought he was being particularly tricky. And then he persisted and said, on the strength of the condition of my barrack room, he was putting my name forward for the officer selection course, among other things. I went back to the barrack room and I tried to unthink what had happened, and I suddenly remembered there was one sick Royal Marine cadet recruit in the barrack room who didn't go on that march. And I'd had to help him through the last 6 or 8 months rather a lot, because he was not the quickest witted young man I'd ever met. And he had stumbled out of bed, and he had, between 4 o'clock in the morning and 7 o'clock in the morning, had put the barrack room to rights. And on the strength of that man's efforts, the officer noted my name and put me forward for the commission. It was some months later before I was sent down from a snowed-up camp to the selection board with the advice from Sergeant Carter, reluctantly given under the heading, "I suppose I'd better give you some advice." One, he said, "Don't forget to speak posh." And two, if they ask you how much money you've got, double it.
Did you?
I wasn't asked those questions.
How did you come to be in RMBPD?
Well, you've got to go back to the Royal Marine Military School there. Royal Marine Military School was a course for men who were in the services, in the Royal Marines, who had been recommended for the officer's course. Also, there were some people who came in as direct entry from outside who had never been in the services. Basically, my class in Thurlston, which is now the Thurlston Hotel, which is the Royal Marine Military School, was mainly men who had seen some service in the Royal Marines, either through intakes to Exton, but there were only two of us who had actually come in through peacetime barracks. I think the course lasted about 4 months, roughly, and I passed out in May 1942, and then we were drafted away to various other establishments, and in my case I was sent, to my fury, to the Royal Marine Small Arms School at Gosport near Portsmouth. Once again, to learn the one thing I did understand, which was small arms and light machine guns, etc. During the course of this period in the Royal Marine Small Arms School, we were told by the commanding officer that a Major X would be visiting the establishment, and that all those young men with none too close domestic ties should attend in a certain Nissen hut and hear Major X and volunteer, if possible, for the job which he was to outline. Major X, of course, was Major H.G. Hasler, who dreamt and created the RMBPD. I was not selected by Hasler as one of his two lieutenants. In fact, McKinnon and I were congratulating ourselves on not being selected at the bar in the mess when our names were called on the tannoy to the commanding officer's office. We reported pretty smartly and were told to get packed, as the commanding officer of the school had overruled Major X and suggested that McKinnon and I were the two people he was looking for. and we joined Hasler in Southsea 7 days later, having had a very short period of leave.
What date would this have been, approximately?
July 1942.
Can you recollect what Hasler said to you at that meeting?
He laid great store on any understanding whatsoever of small boats, coupled with a degree of understanding of light mechanical engineering, and in turn he made no bones about saying that it was not particularly likely to be a very easy job that he was asking us to do, which would certainly involve an enormous amount of work as an individual rather than as an individual in a team rather than working in considerable numbers as in a commando or something bigger than the small section.
Did he say anything about the type of personal qualities that would be needed?
They were certainly mentioned to some considerable extent, but he certainly didn't lay too much stress on that, because he obviously believed that if we passed the military school, we surely did have, at least partially, the needs he was looking for by way of physical fitness and mental ability. There was not too much stress put on courage, which one assumed was going to be there when the time came.
Had you personally had any experience with small boats?
Strangely, yes. Because in Scotland, my grandfather's home, we had played, my cousin and I had, as very small boys, played games with canoes. And I was quite an adequate swimmer. So in some ways you could say knowledge of sailing and very small boats and combined with swimming was something I would get a pass at.
What was the next step after you'd been selected?
Having joined at Southsea, McKinnon and I were put in quarters in Royal Marine Barracks, Portsmouth. And the unit only consisted of Major Hasler, Captain Stewart, McKinnon, and myself. And we started to do what really was testing of the very limited equipment which Hasler had managed to get for his unit, which was yet unformed. And Hasler had an office, had a desk in a research unit run by a Captain RN called Hussey, which the purpose of which was to build these small aggressive toys, such as underwater canoes, explosive motorboats, and anything of this nature. That was the role of this special operations group under Captain Hussey. And it wasn't for probably 3 months that we reached the stage where of going to select volunteers from the various Royal Marine divisions. And I remember being present when these men finally arrived and were billeted in private houses around Southsea. I was particularly happy to find that Corporal King, who had given me hell as a PT corporal, in Plymouth Barracks was to be in my section of 12 men in RMBPD. Obviously, he became one of my greatest friends, and obviously, MacKinnon became probably my closest ever friend.
Was the unit referred to as RMBPD in those days, right from the start?
There was a name before RMBPD, but it was very nearly the same name. I suggest it was called the Royal Marine Beach Patrol Detachment, and then changed to Royal Marine Boom Patrol Detachment, which was an excellent security name, insomuch that our small setup was based on the South Sea end of the boom, which then ran in defence of Portsmouth Heart Waters, really, from South Sea to Sea View on the Isle of Wight. And by way of practice for our canoeing, we used to man that boom on a regular basis with canoeists every night. And it would be perfectly natural for people to assume that our only duty in life was to guard the 4 miles of tubular boom, plus the floating part of it between the forts. And again, the tubular boom and the gates all the way to Sea View. It was the most excellent security name.
Were people universally taken in by the name, or did you ever come across anybody who was suspicious?
I never, in 5 years, ever had anybody doubt, but we were just patrol, defence patrol, with obviously an ability to repair the defence, and therefore were able to dive and this type of stuff.
Can you describe the equipment in more detail that you were working with at South Sea?
Yes, in the early days, we only had foul boats, two-man foul boats, which were rubberized canvas skins over a framework of battens. And for many months, the original training of MacKinnon and myself, and the first intake of 24 men, was done in these canoes. We had not got any special underwater swimming equipment and relied on the Davis Escape submarine apparatus, which was a breathing bag with a purifier on the back, supplied with oxygen. So we had the flimsiest of equipment to learn our trade, both for canoeing and for underwater swimming. Obviously, we had to have oxygen and not compressed air, because compressed air would leave a trail of bubbles on the surface, whereas oxygen on a contained circuit did not. There is an awful danger of living on oxygen, of course, because eventually it will turn to carbon dioxide if you're not careful. And indeed, unhappily, we lost an officer in training for this very reason.
What precautions did you have to take to prevent it happening?
The man had to know that the duration and length of the life of his bottle of oxygen, depending on how much work he was doing, could never exceed 20 minutes.
What other problems were there with the use of this equipment?
A tremendous amount. It was bulky. It was extremely difficult and dangerous to work in it under, for argument's sake, a pontoon, where it tended to float you up towards the surface and jam you in a narrow space. In effect, it was only ever intended to get men out of a submarine on the bottom, straight up a pipe, and to give some form of inflation to assist you get up that pipe. It was never intended as a device to enable you to work, to change your depth, and it was certainly not intended to work where you had projections and sharp obstacles which could easily puncture the whole apparatus.
What about the foul boats? Were they suitable for the job, or did you have any problems with them?
They, of course, were totally unsuitable for the job we were doing, in so much that it was essential that these boats could be pulled along in a loaded condition over a beach, not only a sandy beach, but rocky beaches, and in many cases could it actually be pulled fully loaded across countryside. The only thing that they did for us was teach us how to canoe in all conditions and enabled us to do navigational exercises. They were hopeless from the point of view of lifting into a mother craft, stowing in to the torpedo hatches of the likes of a submarine or anything of this nature. No, they provided the basic training for the seamanship required for the new type of boats, which eventually we got, and they of course had timbered decks and keels, they had canvas sides, they were collapsible, you could stow them full of all the gear you needed on operation.